All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, February 7th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here at UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a foggy snow mist and it's coming down here about an inch an hour here in upstate New York. Sky is very dark and we are getting the moisture coming up from the south. It looks like it goes all the way down to the Gulf and maybe even across Texas and Mexico, maybe coming from the Pacific. I'm not sure. It didn't go too much further than that. But where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Chimeras, Clones, Stem Cells, Immortality, Billionaires, and Healthcare. We had taken a look at a disturbing trend that we've been watching for a while, but it is getting closer and closer to becoming our not-too-distant future, and that is with some of this mad science that they are tinkering with in the laboratory, mixing and matching DNA between species, or figuring out how to clone little monkeys to be able to create, I don't know if they were doing some sort of mental disease or something. And then finding ways to create stem cells for all of our different body parts. So we no longer are unique. We have become a commodity. And then looking at some of the rich tech billionaires and others that are trying to cure death as a disease. And then some of the big names like Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon and Jeff Bezos deciding they're going to throw their hats in and hop into the healthcare market to be able to provide healthcare in this broken system, which I do have to agree, I've kind of been sucked back into the system, and it is very broken. But getting a microchip or some sort of biostatistic tracker that then is fed through the Internet of Things has my data put into a blockchain to be able to then bag tag and run artificially intelligent algorithms against it to see whether or not I'm going to kick the bucket in the next 5 years is not the way I want to go. No, no, no. But anyway, so we're going to continue along the lines of mad science. I've run across quite a number of good DARPA stories over the last few days that maybe we can stitch together into a scary storybook. But this one caught my attention, and I thought this would be a good title to kick off the show for the live day back this week. This is out of ScienceAlert.com. These bacteria digest toxic metals. Now, remember the DARPA lady way back when who talked about in the future with these libraries of genetic material from all these different organisms and figuring out how to biomanufacture, and that would be making life work for its existence by providing some sort of byproduct through its biological mechanisms that would benefit the rich people who have been tinkering with it in the lab. Yes, well, these bacteria, so watch, this will be coming to some sort of Superfund site near you. These bacteria digest toxic metals and poop out tiny gold nuggets. Now, come on. If there were one thing that you would want some sort of toxic metal digesting bacteria to poop out, it would be gold nuggets. This one just made me laugh. Kind of inspired me to want to do a show today. All right, so no other life form on our planet has infiltrated every environment as successfully as the minuscule single cells of bacteria. And among their many roles in life on Earth, it turns out that some of these microbes are also experts at purifying precious metals. An international team of researchers has figured out how one metal-gobbling bacteria called the Cuprivatus metal gerons manages to ingest toxic metal compounds and then still thrive, producing tiny gold nuggets as a side effect. Like many other elements, gold can move through what is known as a biogeochemical cycle, being dissolved, shifted around, and eventually reconcentrated in the Earth's sediment. Microbes are involved in every step of this process, which has led scientists to wonder how they don't get poisoned by the highly toxic compounds that gold ions usually form in soil. The rod-shaped sea metal endurance was the first found to poop out gold nuggets back in 2009 when scientists discovered that it somehow manages to ingest toxic gold compounds and then convert them into the element's metallic form without any apparent danger to the organism itself. The result of this study points to their involvement in the active detoxification of gold complexes, leading to the formation of gold biominerals, says lead researcher geomicrobiologist Frank Reith in 2009. Now, after years of investigation, Reith and his colleagues finally know the precise mechanism of how bacterium achieves this amazing feat. Sea metal endurans thrives in soils which contain both hydrogen and a range of toxic heavy metals, and this means that the bacterium don't have much competition from other organisms that can be easily poisoned in such an environment. If an organism chooses to survive here, it has to find a way to protect itself from these toxic substances. And as it turns out, the bacterium has a pretty ingenious protective mechanism, which involves not just gold, but also copper. Compounds containing both of these elements can easily get into the sea metal duran cells. And once inside, they interact in such a way that the copper ions and the gold complexes get transported deep inside the bacterium, where they could potentially wreak havoc. But to deal with this problem, the bacteria employs enzymes to shift the offending metals out of their cells. For copper, that is an enzyme called CUPA, but the presence of gold causes a new problem. When the gold compounds are also present, the enzyme is suppressed and the toxic copper and the gold compounds remain inside the cell. So at this point, other bacteria might just give up and go live somewhere else less toxic, but not the sea metal endurans. This organism has another enzyme up its sleeve, which scientists have labeled CUPA versus CUPA and CUPA. With this molecule, the bacterium can convert the copper and the gold compounds into forms that are less easily absorbed by the cell, and this assures that a few copper and gold compounds enter the cellular interior. This bacterium is poisonless, and the enzyme that pumps out the copper can dispose of the excess copper unimpeded. I bet this is going to make someone $1 billion with all of these toxic manufacturing and governmental sites sitting all over the globe. You know, today it's copper and gold. Tomorrow it's going to be something else that'll make them bazillions of dollars as well. The results of this research, which build upon previous work by the same team, are fascinating insight into the workings of a strange microbe and, of course, how we can splice and dice other microbes to make them do our bidding. But on top of that, the bacterium's weird talent could actually be put to a good use. Understanding how sea metal endurans can poop out a gold nugget means scientists have gotten a huge step closer to unlocking the biogeochemical cycle of gold. And in the future, these insights could then be used to refine the precious metal from ores that contain only small amounts of metal, something that is very tricky currently. Well, good. So we'll be able to make lots of money and won't need to mine Africa anymore. So where do we go from here? This title caught my attention as well, my DARPA feed. DARPA executive is coming out and warning biohackers, as they're doing all kinds of scary things down long, dark hallways. They're warning biohackers to, quote, think deeply, unquote, about injecting themselves with untested treatments. Now, we found out the FDA kind of frowned a little bit on some of that DIY biohacker stuff. Well, on stage at the Body Hacking Con this weekend, and this was published yesterday, so I guess we just missed the Body Hacking Con. DARPA Director of Biological Technologies Justin Sanchez ran through an impressive list of the sort of government projects that might interest people attending the conference about the integration of humans and technology, and including the plans to prevent global pandemics by turning the body, oops, into a bioreactor. Now, that's what that bacteria was that we just read about that poops out gold. That is called a bioreactor. And to restore memory through technologies like brain-computer interfaces. So anybody who is maybe a little into this transhumanism agenda and being able to hack your bodies like computers, step right up because we want you to come help us think up mad science technologies. But Sanchez was not only there to promote the agency's expansive research portfolio, he also had a message of urgent caution for so-called biohackers, and that would be people who have decided that the formal drug research and approval process is too cumbersome and who are using themselves as guinea pigs, ding ding, for increasingly more ambitious biology experiments. We may be comfortable with the risk today, but there are risks we haven't considered, he told the crowd. Never shy away from these kinds of questions. Come work for DARPA. But I know this community is ultimately going to change the world. And in an interview after his stage talk, Sanchez was more circumspect. More and more people have access to biotechnology. Remember, you found out that we could buy a few centrifuges on eBay for just a few bucks and be able to do DIY biohacking in mommy's back bedroom. It is very democratized, he told me, and people need to think deeply. If you have access to it, does it mean that you should use it? Well, very good question there, Justin. His message would not be heeded the very next day at the conference when one biohacker injected himself on stage, whoops, with an extremely experimental treatment for herpes. And the therapy had gone through no regulatory approval process and had never before been tested in humans. Well, yeah, I wonder if they arrested him. It was not the first time such a bold experiment has taken place in the biohacking community, and we had read about two different experiments. So we found out that Ira Pastor from BioQuark actually knew both of those people. In October, the company behind the herpes stunt sponsored another experiment in which a person injected themselves with an untested HIV treatment during a Facebook live stream. And over the summer, another biohacker injected himself with CRISPR and a gene to promote muscle growth at a synthetic biology conference. And the rush of DIY genetic experimentation in humans is prompting strong words from the FDA. And we read about that warning. Sanchez brought up the internet for which DARPA's precursor developed the foundational technology. And with all technologies, when people started getting excited, they take it in a lot of different directions. So don't inject yourself. Uh-oh. Hold on 1 second. My browser just disappeared. Here it comes back. That's what enables technologies to mature and branch out into different areas that no one ever expected. And I would expect for biotechnologies, the same thing is going to happen. But he said that this leads to unforeseen problems. There are many levels of safety and security for the internet that we as a society are struggling with, especially as we are all addicted. And in the early days of biological technologies, let's think about how to do this in a responsible way so that as the technology does mature, we are better prepared to use it in a way that benefits society and not make cyborgs. He didn't say that, but I did. Sanchez says that he has concerns that if biohackers fail to think through all the consequences of their work, they could wind up getting hurt and making the Isle of Dr. Moreau and scaring people away. And some of DARPA's newer programs, in fact, intend to come up with ways to offset the consequences of biological research gone wrong, like the Safe Genes program. And we're going to talk about that again next, which is exploring ways to reverse genetic engineering gone wrong, among other things. DARPA was at the Body Hacking Con, and he says, in hopes of spurring a dialogue that is approaching biohacking safely. It is easy to promise something in front of an audience, but it's a very different thing to actually show how the technology is working with a human in a very safe way and how it can have impact. All right, so now let's look at the Safe Genes Toolkit. This they started talking about last summer, July of 2017. Building the Safe Genes Toolkit from DARPA.mil. Seven teams aim to develop new knowledge and tools to support responsible innovation in gene editing and protecting against threats to the genome integrity. Now remember, there is a war going on internationally, not only with artificial intelligence, but also in genetic engineering. We found out China is way further ahead than the United States in a lot of these technologies. And there are all kinds of crazy bio labs that are being run by contractors to the government under diplomatic cover in former Eastern Bloc Soviet nations, which really is to scare you, with scientists that date back, knowledge that dates back to some of the early years of the biowarfare programs. DARPA, of course, has warned that maybe some of those rogue actors could use some of these technologies. We had Clapper, who's the head of the intelligence agency group, come out in front of the Foreign Intelligence Committee warning that gene editing could be a WMD of the future. So, of course, we have to look at this as a matter of national security. So DARPA created the Safe Genes Program to gain a fundamental understanding of how gene editing technologies function. And remember, we can also add Georgie Porgy Church to a lot of this research, and devise means to safely, responsibly, and predictably harness them for beneficial ends. Right, of course, we are not part of the military mad science arm. No, let's make sure this is all being done beneficially and address the potential health and security concerns related to their accidentally or on purpose misuse. Today, DARPA announced awards to 7 teams that will pursue that mission, led by, number one, the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, which Georgie Porgy Church has access to. Number two, the Harvard Medical School. Number three, Massachusetts General Hospital. Number four, MIT. Now remember, all these groups are all connected, all four of them, as well as the North Carolina State University, the University of California, Berkeley. And Berkeley is where Jennifer Doudna is. And the University of California, Riverside. DARPA also plans to invest $65 million in the Safe Genes Project over the next 4 years as these teams work to collect empirical data and develop a suite of versatile tools that can be applied independently or in combination to support bioinnovation and combat biothreats. Now, there was a lot of mumbo-jumbo there. They didn't actually give you any substance as to what this program is about, but we had read originally that this program was about being able to potentially reverse a gene splicing and dicing that might have gone wrong or might have been by a rogue actor. This would be to control the gene editing process. Gene editing technologies have captured increasing attention from healthcare professionals, policymakers, and community leaders in recent years, as well as military, for their potential to selectively disable cancerous cells in the body, yeah, and to control populations of disease-spreading mosquitoes, right, those Zika mosquitoes, and defend native flora and fauna against invasive species. And that would be with the Insect Allies program, to be able to genetically modify crops and plants on the fly by genetically modifying insects that'll go in and eat the plants and then infect them with their infected genetically modified spittle that then would take hold in the plant and genetically modify it during its life cycle in vivo. The national security applications and implications of these technologies are equally profound, including protection of troops against infectious diseases, mitigations of threats posed by irresponsible or nefarious use of biological technologies, and enhanced development of new resources derived from synthetic biology, such as novel chemicals, materials, and coatings with useful and unique properties. Guys, this is just the way this is worded. It is just so floral in verbose that they kind of work around it so you don't actually get slapped in the face with what they are doing here. Well, let's move a step forward, because that was 2017. Now, I ran across an update to some of this. DARPA is now holding, and this is February 5th, 2018, a proposer's day on WMD exposure detection technology development. Now, what does that mean? Well, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, will host a proposer's day on February 23rd, 2018 in Arlington, Virginia, to discuss a program that aims to develop technologies that can detect whether an individual has been exposed to materials associated with weapons of mass destruction. And remember, it isn't just a nuclear weapon, and it isn't just I don't know. What else is a WMD? WMD is chemical weapon. It's also biological weapons that would include things such as pandemics and accidentally running gene drives through a population, maybe even humans, or crops, or genetically modified insects. It's all the different types of those international conventions that we supposedly inked back in the early 70s. We're not supposed to be messing around with. Yeah, it's all that stuff. DARPA said on Friday, which was February 2nd, that the Epigenetic Characterization and Observation Program, more affectionately known as ECHO, would create a portable platform designed to read a person's epigenome, which is their biological record keeper of environmental conditions that left their marks on the human DNA. We hope that with the capabilities developed within the ECHO program, someone in the field will immediately know if a suspected adversary has handled or been exposed to threat agents. So we're all going to be epigenetically characterized in the future, it sounds. The same technology, with a mobile platform, the same technology could also serve as a diagnostic tool for our own troops to diagnose infectious diseases or reveal exposure to threat agents so that medical countermeasures can be applied in time to make a difference. ECHO researchers will work over a four-year period at the identification of epigenetic signatures created through the exposure to threat agents, as well as build technologies, probably some sort of artificial intelligence, in a mobile platform that could show the exact type and the time of exposure. DARPA also wants the device to be able to conduct multiple molecular analyses and onboard bioinformatics within 30 minutes, as well as deliver the technology in a portable system that would require minimal training. The department seeks to discuss, hold on, an ad just popped up, research plans, potential challenges, and social implications of ECHO within ethical and legal expertise in the scientific community. Yeah, what are the ethics of this? All right, so now let's read a little bit more. So there was an announcement. Now, this is off of DARPA site. Reading the body's history of threat exposure, epigenetic technology will provide a new tool in the fight against WMD proliferation. So guys, this is all going to be done in the name of national security. Step right up and give us your blood sample. We need your DNA. Picture an intelligence officer in the field. They're trying to piece together a suspected threat and has access to someone who may have a role in carrying it out. There may be traces of biological or chemical agents on their clothes or in their hair, and they can look for them, but they are transient and often present in such low concentrations that they will need to send samples to a laboratory. Or they can pick up genetic markers, read a history of any time that there's been exposure to threat agents, and start piecing together a chain of evidence right there in the field in real time. DARPA's new epigenetic characterization and observation, more affectionately known as ECHO program, aims to build a field deployable platform technology that quickly reads someone's epigenome and identifies signatures that indicate whether the person has ever, in his or her entire lifetime, been exposed to materials that could be associated with weapons of mass destruction or whatever we want to look for. The epigenome is the biology's record keeper, and though the DNA does not change over a single lifetime, the person's environmental factors may leave marks on the DNA that modify how the individual's genes are expressed. And I would have to say, that would be things that you were exposed to that maybe flip some switches on and off that maybe are telltale signs that you've had exposure. And this is one way that people can adapt and survive in changing conditions. And the epigenome is a combination of all of these modifications. Though modifications can register within seconds to minutes, they imprint on the epigenome for decades, leaving a time-stamped biography in an individual's exposure that is difficult to deliberately alter. Oh my God. Whereas current forensics and diagnostic screening technologies can only detect the immediate presence of contaminants, this envisioned ECHO program would be able to read someone's epigenome from a biological sample, such as a fingerprint or a nasal swab, to reveal possible exposure to WMDs or WMD precursors, even when other physical evidence has been erased. Whoa. It's like taking a hair sample and being able to look at the last year's worth of what you've done to your body. But even more so, this is that on steroids. The human body registers exposure and logs them in the epigenome. And we are just beginning to understand the rich biographical record that we can carry around with us. Yes, this is only the beginning. We hope that with the capabilities developed within ECHO, someone in the field will immediately know if a suspected adversary has handled or been exposed to a threat agent, or whether or not Johnny has eaten Cheetos, even though he said he hasn't. The same technology could also serve as a diagnostic tool for our troops to diagnose infectious diseases or reveal exposure to threat agents so that medical countermeasures can be applied in time. Researchers of this four-year ECHO program will have two primary challenges, and that would be to identify and discriminate epigenetic signatures created by exposure to threat agents, and then create a technology that performs highly specific forensic and diagnostic analyses to reveal the exact time and type of exposure. To develop this capability, and think about this, because they could program this to look for signatures for your exposure to anything. If they can identify what it does to the epigenome, they could then build a program that would look for those specific signatures. Nothing will be private anymore. To develop this capability, researchers will have to assemble a foundational training data set of pre- and post-exposure epigenetic readouts in a biological sample. They will also have to create a device capable of performing multiple molecular analyses and onboard bioinformatics in 30 minutes or less, compared to an average of 2 days using current lab center processes. This is a lab on demand. And by the end of the effort, DARPA's goal is to deliver ECHO's capabilities in a man-made portable device that can be used by an operator with minimal training. ECHO could open up new sources of forensic evidence and make battlefield collection of evidence safer, more efficient, and more accurate. And right, how long is this going to be before it is rolled out to the police forces doing predictive policing all across the world? And additionally, by making it possible to deploy an analytical capability to vastly more locations, it would enhance our ability to conduct global near real-time surveillance, ding, 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 of possible emerging threats like you and me. ECHO is focused specifically on diminishing the threat posed by WMDs and improving diagnostics for troops who have been exposed to threat agents. And like I said, it doesn't have to be just biomedical or biochemical warfare type agents or things like that. I mean, if they can take a look at some sort of epigenetic profile for maybe being defiant or not following the rules or not eating the bullshit that they try to feed us every day, you know, they could run some sort of test, maybe knowing or unknowing on you, and be able to determine who's with the game and who is not. DARPA will host Proposers Day, February 23rd, 2018, and you are to be available to answer questions, and details are available online. So I have a link to that if anyone is interested. So let's take it a step further. I have to subscribe now. Damn it. You know, these paywalls are getting very upsetting. Well, I guess we're not going to read about DARPA working on their universal flu vaccine, but that was another one where they were talking about splicing and dicing, messing with their immune system to be able to genetically modify humans, though maybe at some point in the future it would be reversible, to be able to have our immune system react to any threat, known or unknown, to protect us against bioterror. Well, now let's take a look at this one. We're going to go another step further. So DARPA, we found out DARPA is hosting their Grand Collaboration Spectrum Challenge. And that is going on right now, where they're talking about putting artificial intelligence in charge of splicing and dicing the radio spectrum. Because, of course, with this manacle rollout of 5G so we can have ubiquitous connectivity all across the globe on a global timeline. We are running out of spectrum and the old way of doing things by licensing slices of the pie in the multiplexed global radio spectrum is archaic, and we have to find a new way to do it. So let's talk about the Grand Spectrum Collaboration Challenge. DARPA, and this is out of govconexecutive.com, 1 week ago, DARPA to host live event for Spectrum Collaboration Challenge finale in 2019. The Defense Advanced Research Project Agency will host a live event next year for the finale of a three-year collaborative machine intelligence competition designed to mitigate challenges related to spectrum scarcity. Yeah, that's what they call it. DARPA said on Tuesday that they will host the Spectrum Collaboration Challenge finale event simultaneously with the, in quote, 2019 Mobile World Congress. Now, any of us who have been following 5G and watching lectures and reading papers know that that Mobile World Congress is pretty big in this rollout globally of 5G that is coming. We're going to talk more about that in the future. But they're going to host their Spectrum Collaboration Challenge finale simultaneously with the 2019 Mobile World Congress Annual Conference in partnership with the GSM Association and the CTIA. The Spectrum Collaboration Challenge, more affectionately known as the SC2, aims to create new approaches and wireless strategies wherein radio networks can autonomously, ding, ding, decide how to effectively utilize the electromagnetic spectrum through artificial intelligence, machine learning, and software-defined radio technologies. Now, that's a big one. Software-defined radios are putting all of the manual tuning that we used to have to go through for standard radios of the past and putting that on a chip so now it can be scanned automatically and you can then pick up things that maybe you couldn't before. Guys, this is the beginnings of Skynet, and I know I've said that before, but it really seriously is. If you think about what is coming and this connection from healthcare to the Internet of Things, to our enchanted objects in our smart homes, our self-driving cars, our smart cities, our launching of the blockchain and tying it all to kinds of different micropayments and financial incentives to sell our data to this back end of smart technology that, of course, is being run by artificial intelligence and predictive policing and things of that nature. We are going to be bathed in this radio frequency, of course, that there's a lot more information coming out about the dangers, not only of cell phones, and that would be some of the current technologies that we have that are in the microwave frequency, but also some of these higher frequencies that are still in microwave and borderlining into the millimeter wave frequencies that I think are still in the microwave, but at higher frequencies and the damage that this can do to our biology. Remember, DARPA was looking at that radio bio program to see whether or not our cells communicate at different radio frequencies. Well, I'm going to tell you guys, this coming ubiquitous 5G cage that they are dropping over the planet to be able to get all those poor people in Africa that aren't connected to this global database where they're going to be bagging, tagging, and tracking even down to a genetic and epigenetic level your digital identities that are going to be tied to this as well for that UNID 2020 project. Again, tied to the blockchain. We want to move forward with a lot of caution, if we're going to be feeding not only all this data, but then the control of the frequencies where the Defense Department is doing all kinds of development and energy weaponry, We've read about that a lot in the past as well. Laser weapons and terahertz weapons. Millimeter wave weapons. For crowd control and things of that nature. Non-ionizing radiation weapons. Sound weapons as well. When we turn all of this information, it's not only all the chinks in the human armor down to a genetic level, but then also all of these radio frequencies and all these MRI scans and CAT scans and all this research that they are doing. We feed all of this into this big pulsating brain in the sky to be able to manipulate and control at will autonomously. You gotta be scared. I tell you guys, it's been really tough for me. You know, I'm sure some of you who listen regularly notice I've been taking a few days off every week, but I have to. You know, this stuff has been causing me not only anxiety when I really sit back and think about the consequences of all this that is coming, but also there's a lot of sitting that goes along with this because you're sitting in front of a computer doing lots of research. And I tell you, over the last couple of days, I've made use of my days off. I'm going to go off topic for a minute because this has helped me combat a little of this mentally. I got an exercise bike probably about 6 months ago after I got out of the hospital, and it sat here because I made all these excuses how I had to reorganize my desk first before I could use it while I was doing my show. Well, we have found a way. Thank you to one of my listeners who helped me with this. There was a little application in the browser called OneTab that allows you to push a button and it sucks every single one of your tabs into one HTML page that you can then open at will. And then you can push a button that goes to the text version of all of that in a list. You can copy and paste it. So it's been helping me get my notes done very quickly as opposed to hours sitting here in this chair. So I have cut down my time that it takes me to do a show every day after the show to do the notes. But I've been spending a lot more time working on things such as writing and researching other topics that I don't necessarily spend days on here because I'm working on them somewhere else. But so what I've ended up doing over the last 2 days, Monday, I was able to put my notebook on a little desk on this bike and pedal 17.46 miles in a day, if you can even believe it, which was quite a boon for me because I don't think I maybe once when I was like 13 or 14, I was in a bike-a-thon that did like 30 some odd miles, but I don't think I'd ever done that much in one sitting. And then on Tuesday, I had to beat it. So I was able to work and I did 17.5 miles yesterday. Today, I'm kind of hurting a little bit. I feel like I may have pulled a few muscles. But anyway, the good news is the very first day I noticed such a huge boost to like my brain could not turn off. I couldn't shut it down. But the blood supply was really good. And it actually put me in quite a good mood, got me out of this doom and gloom mode and got me thinking about spring and all kinds of projects that I would like to do to keep myself busy here, to do other things and live, not actually just live in this world. So let me make a recommendation to everyone. Get up off your butt and do some sort of exercise, because even though it kind of sucks trying to get motivated, I kind of forced myself, and I'm glad I did, because it was very beneficial to me, kind of got me out of where they want me to be, which is kind of sucked into this control mechanism to be able to dangle carrots in front of me and get me sucked down into their negativity. So, all right, so where do we go from here? So this Grand Spectrum Collaboration Challenge, the finale is going to be at the 2019 Mobile World Congress. And they're planning on turning over the entire radio frequency spectrum because of spectrum scarcity over to artificial intelligence and machine learning so they can splice and dice it at will. DARPA noted that the participants will be judged based on their capability to develop a radio design that can coexist within other systems in the current wireless communications environment. So now we find a story, and we'll read this one just because I know both Heather Callaghan, who runs Natural Blaze, and Derek Brose, who wrote the story. He actually has been on Nick Burnaby's show before, Antimedia Radio, and he's also been on Corbett before. New study, and this is just one of many that I have seen recently. If anybody is interested, search Barry Trower, B-A-R-R-I-E, Trower, and on YouTube. And he was a Royal Air Force microwave technician back during the Cold War, I believe, 50s and the 60s, maybe even the 40s, in England. And he worked on submarines, I think, maybe. But he is currently a physics professor who teaches this type of stuff. And I also read that he at one point worked for MI5 consulting on some of these technologies. He's also provided reports to some of the local police departments on these technologies for utilizing different radio frequencies and I don't know, maybe if it was even radar guns and that type of thing. But he's quite an expert in his field. But Barry Trower gives some really awesome interviews in regards to microwave technology, 5G, our Wi-Fi that all of our computers connect to, and some of the damage that it is doing to us biologically. Well, a new study links cell phone radiation to tumors in male rats. And if you didn't believe it before, maybe you should now, because I'm telling you there is a definite connection from everything that I have read about. Preliminary report from the U.S. National Toxicology Program has found that male rats exposed to high levels of cell phone radiation develop tumors. Now, cell phone radiation is microwaves. A new report from the U.S. government is likely to create further debate regarding whether or not cell phones and other mobile devices can pose a cancer risk to humans. According to a draft report from the researchers at the United States National Toxicology Program, male rats exposed to high levels of cell phone radiation develop tumors in the tissue surrounding their hearts. So this isn't just but in their brains, this is their hearts as well. The report also found that female rats and mice exposed to the same amount of radiation did not develop tumors, and Reuters reported on the release in the preliminary report. Reuters reports, however, the scientists of the National Toxicology Program and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration were quick to say that these findings could not be extrapolated to humans and that the current safety limits on cell phone radiation are protective. This 10-year, $25 million study, the most comprehensive assessment of health effects and exposure to radio frequency radiation in rats and mice to date, does raise new questions about exposure to ubiquitous devices. Ding, ding, and ling, and ling. That is our devices that are going to be connected everywhere in our environment. And all of these small cell antennas that are going to be rolled out every 500 feet or so throughout our neighborhoods, that we will have no say in where they are placed. So they could be placed on a light post right outside your child's bedroom window, and there'll be nothing that you can do about it in the future. We've been watching videos on some of these things that have been happening throughout communities in the United States. It's going to get even worse. This study involved exposing rats and mice to higher levels of radiation for longer periods than is typically experienced by the average cell phone user. But researchers also exposed the entire bodies of rats and mice to this high dosage of radiation, and the report concluded that cell phones typically emit lower levels of radiation than the maximum allowable limit. Interestingly, John Butcher, a senior scientist with the national study, told Reuters that the tumors seen in the studies are, quote, similar to tumors previously reported in the studies of frequent cell phone users. A statement from the American Cancer Society said that the findings of these studies are inconclusive. Of course they did. For example, the newly released results show little indication of an increased tumor risk or any other health problems in the mice exposed to the radio frequencies. Also, the male rats exposed to them lived on average significantly longer than the male rats who were not exposed, and the reasons for this are not clear. Yes, they're going to come out and tell you that radio frequencies are good for you. The American Cancer Society also noted that the study had not been peer-reviewed yet by outside experts, and peer review is expected in March, but Dr. Otis Brawley, the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society, called the evidence for association between cell phones and cancer weak, pointing to an apparent lack of higher cancer risk in humans. But if you are concerned about this animal data, then wear an earpiece. But Here's the question that I ask, and that is, as these devices are rolling out throughout our homes, throughout our schools, throughout our cities with hotspots and our coffee shops, throughout everywhere, we are going to have not only Wi-Fi, but smart devices that'll all be connecting via some form of radio frequency or sound frequency. We found the sonic chirps, ultrasound is also another way that devices can communicate. And there was some, I don't remember what it was called, close proximity cellular that we read about a while ago that is also rolling out. And then Li-Fi, that was something else that had came up in a conversation recently, being able to use light. And I think it could transfer. They have hopes of 242 gigabytes per second or something with Li-Fi. This is crazy. This is all going to be polluting our environments. We can't see, hear, smell, or taste any of this. It'll just be bathing us 24/7, unless we're in a little lead room or a Faraday cage. The Food and Drug Administration released a statement affirming their support for the current safety limits as acceptable for protecting the public health. Of course they did. And to be clear, this is not the first time these studies examining the dangers of radio frequency, such as cell phones and microwaves, have caused controversy. Studies in both Australia and India have found that men who use their cell phones more often have lower sperm counts than those who use cell phones less often. And in addition, in 2011, the World Health Organization for Research on Cancer classified radio frequency emissions from cell phones as possibly carcinogenic to humans. There are also studies which have concluded that there is no risk of cancer or other illnesses, of course, from the radiation released by cell phones, and those are probably financed by the cell phone industry. And then an 18-month study from Denmark compared cancer rates of 360,000 cell phone users to adults without cell phone subscriptions, and then they found no connection to brain or spinal cord tumors. More recently, in 2017, it was revealed that the California Department of Public Health had issued internal guidelines on how to reduce exposure to cell phone radiation. The guidelines including keeping the phone away from the bed at night, removing headsets when not on a call, and reducing streaming of audio or video on cell phones. And the guidelines were released to the public as a result of a lawsuit filed by Dr. Joel Moskowitz of UC Berkeley. Moskowitz sued the California Department of Public Health after they failed to release the information about the potential dangers of cell phones back in 2009. Currently, we're not doing a good job in regulating radiation of these devices. In fact, we are doing an abysmal job. In the response to the release of the guidelines, Dr. Karen Smith of the California Department of Public Health recommended that users keep cell phones at least an arm's length away from the body and not carry them in your pockets. They said that they do not believe that cell phones are carcinogens, but rather that the science is, quote unquote, evolving. Yeah, there you have it. It's evolving, but let's take one step forward into the world of disbelief. We read about this one before, but I thought this was an appropriate place to put it again. So we find out that DARPA is looking at handing the entire radio frequency spectrum to artificial intelligence to splice and dice on the fly and be able to control all of the radio frequencies here on the ground and in the sky. We also found out that potentially, at least in the microwave range, there is question as to whether or not there is a biological impact on humans. Well, then we ran across this story, and this originally came out in 2014, but then they had done another follow-up out of South Korea. Electromagnetic production of stem cells. Remember this one? The subject matter is unusual, and where it is published is unusual, and it is also unusual that no one seems to have noticed it. The author of this story, Derek Lowe, had not either, until a reader sent it along to him. And I'm going to tell you, any of my listeners who send me information, I want to thank everybody out there, because my listeners of this show have actually renewed my faith in humanity, which is a good thing because I had some pretty low opinions of it a while ago. But you guys who send me stuff and who comment on the show and who interact with me about some of the craziness I see, it really is a big boost to keep me going every day, because this is a pretty thankless thing. If you want to know the honest to God truth, after 7 years, it's pretty difficult to feel motivated to get up and do this, though it is therapeutic, but I just want you to know that. So a reader did him a solid and sent this along to him, so he has some comments about it. And it was titled, Electromagnetic Fields Mediate Efficient Cell Reprogramming into a Pluripotent State. You remember we've talked about pluripotent stem cells. Those would be those iPS stem cells that they could take skin cells, scrape them off into a petri dish, mix them up with a few chemicals, and turn them into any type of stem cell that they want in the body. Well, yes, this paper that he had been reading says that stem cells can be produced from ordinary somatic cells by exposure to electromagnetic fields. Well, who would have thunk it? Everyone will recall the fervor that attended the reports that cells could be reprogrammed by exposure to weak acid baths. And that's what I was talking about, mixing it up with a few chemicals in a petri dish. But one answer might be that not many people who care about stem cell biology read the publication ACS Nano, and there is probably something to that. Yes, because they published this story in a nanotechnology publication. But that immediately makes you wonder why the paper is appearing there to start with, because it's also hard to see how it relates to nanotechnology per se. But an uncharitable guess would be that the manuscript made its rounds of several higher profile and more appropriate journals and finally ended up where it is. So what does the paper itself have to say? It claims that extremely low frequency electromagnetic fields can cause somatic cells to transform into pluripotent stem cells. And that is the process that is mediated by EMF effects on a particular enzyme. And that would be the histone methyl transferase, MII2. That is an H3K4 methyl transferase and has been found to be particularly important in germline stem cells, ding, ding, and spermatogenesis. That would be germline cells such as eggs and sperm, and that would be having effects on things that produce the next generation. Otherwise, I have not seen anyone suggesting it as a master regulator of stem cell generation, but then there is a lot that we don't know about epigenetics. And stem cells. Ding, 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 ding. There you go, guys. And DARPA is putting a huge amount of research into epigenetics and stem cells. There is, however, a lot that we know about electromagnetism, and over the years, and so will DARPA with their artificial intelligence and their Grand Spectrum Collaboration Challenge. Over the years, there have been uncountable reports of biological activity in electromagnetic fields. You can go back to the controversy over the effects of power lines in residential areas, and then later disputes about the effects of cell phones, just to pick the two that have the vast amount of coverage. But the problem is, no one seems to have been able to demonstrate anything definite in any of these cases until what they are saying just recently. And as far as I know, studies have either shown no real effects or something has turned up and no one has been able to reproduce it. That goes for laboratory studies and for attempts at observational and epidemiological studies. Nothing too definite over and over again. So the probable reason for that is I have trouble with is the mechanism in which enzymes get induced by low-frequency electromagnetic fields, and that has always been a basic argument against such things. You also have to assume new physics to make a strong connection, but they actually did do it, and it was in South Korea, I believe. Because nothing seems to fit. The energies involved are too weak, he says. Absorptions just don't match up and blah, blah, blah. The author says that the maximum effect in their study was seen at 50 hertz, and that is indeed really, really low frequency. The wavelength for a radio signal down there is about 6,000 kilometers, and it just getting antennas to work in that range is a major challenge, and it's hard for me to picture how subcellular structures could respond to these wavelengths at all. But if you guys remember, and I don't have the story lined up, but we read a story about how they had just discovered that within the skin, they had discovered these helical skin antennas. Do you remember that? So hold on 1 second. Skin antenna. Wireless signals creep over the human skin. Let's sing for a second. Do 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 do. I am clicking on it and it's not doing anything. Do 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 do. Well, we might just have to remember it fondly. Oh, here we go. Skin antenna wireless signal creeps over human skin. Wireless antennas that channel signals along the human skin could broadcast signals over your body. And this is actually an Internet of Things device, but they had found skin antennas, helical, but it was skin antennas or something. Human skins as antenna arrays. Here we go, of helical something or other. Human skin antenna arrays of helical antennas in the millimeter and submillimeter wave range. Well, guess what? That is where a lot of our 5G is going to be. Recent studies of the minute morphology of the skin by optical coherence tomography, which would be OCR, showed that sweat ducts in the human skin are helically shaped filled tubes filled with a conductive aqueous solution, which also has salt in it. This, together with the fact that the dielectric permittivity of the dermis is higher than that of the epidermis, brings forward the supposition that as electromagnetic entities, the sweat ducts in our skin could be regarded as low-Q helical antennas. Inherent to this supposition is the requirement that the ducts possess an electrical conductance mechanism that is effective at high frequency ranges, and the mechanism that qualifies for such a requirement is the fast proton hopping through distributed H-bond networks along a duct's inner surface. So there you go, guys. Our skin is a helical antenna in the millimeter and the submillimeter wave range. So maybe they can use that to flip switches within our cells to turn on and off stem cells. I don't know. All I got to say is that it isn't going to be good for us as they turn these autonomous machines on. And here's a new one out of DARPA. U.S. and China are now preparing for artificially intelligent submarine warfare. Technological developments could see AI-powered warships attack each other as concerns rise regarding autonomous weapons. DARPA just launched a brand new autonomous submarine, and they handed over to the Navy. Artificial intelligence is reported by being integrated in Chinese nuclear submarines. The way the U.S. Navy has taken control of an experiment of autonomous submarine hunting vessels from the Research Advanced Defense Department Agency. All right, guys, have an awesome Wednesday. I will catch up with you.